This is Creating Windows, Not Bars, a monthly show on Justice Radio on WMPG with your hosts Mackenzie Kelly and Linda Small. Today we are talking with Christy Puckett, Senior Project Manager for Forward Justice, about her work as a gender and racial justice policy expert.
But first, a little information about us. I'm Mackenzie Kelly, a recovery coach and peer mentor coordinator of Healthy Acadia and the program director of Reentry Sisters.
And I'm Linda Small, a project coordinator with Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition and executive director of Reentry Sisters, an organization with a trauma-informed and gender approach to reentry support.
For the past 2 years, we have worked together to provide support and community for justice-impacted women as they reunify with their families, look for work and housing, and complete their educational aspirations. Our show explores safety and community and asks what it's like for people to come home after serving time in prison. Today, we're talking about bringing awareness to racial and gender justice in the carceral system and beyond. Hi, Christy. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll begin with an introduction. Could you please tell me a bit about your background and what brought you to gender and racial justice work?
My name is Christy Puckett. I am from North Carolina, and I come through this work, I guess, through my own pain. I was a young woman who was involved, a young mother involved in a very violent relationship. And it was through that violence that I entered into the carceral state. I had my victimhood and my substance use disorder criminalized. And through the criminalization of my victimhood and my substance use disorder, I learned just how punitive the criminal legal system is. I learned that women and girls are not treated, well, nobody really is treated fairly or properly within the system, but women and girls especially are not treated fairly within a system because we're not seen as whole people, I guess, to begin with. And then when you add race on top of that, Black people aren't seen as whole people to begin with. And then you add on top of that, being a woman or a girl, and not even a woman, a female, you know, because, you know, being a female places you out of personhood just because a female can be anything, right? That right there takes you out of personhood. And so I just think that it was through those realizations of being placed in the system as a victim, as someone who needed help, who needed treatment and was offered punishment. I think it was there that I realized that it was on me. If I was going to get better, that better was on me. And that the only person that I could rely on was myself, and that I had to make better decisions. And yeah, the onus was on me, right? That my safety was on me, my health and well-being was on me, that nobody was going to make sure I was straight but me. And once I realized that and really operated it with that mindset, things got better. And I then took that and began to work on community safety, which is the understanding that we keep us safe, right? That we do have the resources to keep ourselves safe, that police and systems don't keep us safe, mm-hmm. that I am powerful. I do have what it takes to keep myself safe and to keep those around me safe. That when I was pregnant while incarcerated, while the system only fed me 1,200 calories a day, did not take me to the doctor, did not make sure I had prenatal care, that the people around me made sure I ate. They provided me with commissary. They made sure that I had swoles every single night, that people I didn't even speak to made sure that I had a newspaper every day because I needed that plastic that newspaper came in to make sure that my food was able to be made and prepared in every single night, right? They ain't even talk to me because we ain't like each other. But I didn't have a subscription to a newspaper and they did. So, you know what I mean? And so like that is what keeping each other safe looks like. And so like I learned what solidarity looks like inside of a carceral space, radical solidarity. Principle solidarity. And so when you ask me what racial and social justice looks like, what gender justice looks like, it looks like being principled. It looks like being valued beyond surface level, liking someone or not, right? Because there was lots of conflicts and tensions inside But we did not allow those conflicts and tensions to diminish our humanity in a way that if you did not have what you needed, even if I did not like you, I made sure you had what you needed, right? There was nobody who didn't have a deodorant or a soap. You know, if your shower shoes was raggedy, you had shower shoes, babe. You know what I mean? And so, like, when I think about what I know about humans, I learned inside of trap houses. And I learned inside of jailhouses and prison houses and poor houses and some of the worst houses per se, but really with some of the best houses because I learned what danger and safety was in the same way, right? In the same time, simultaneously, you know? And so I know that's a long answer and it's probably convoluted sounding, but like what's understood don't have to be explained. Those listening who understand, you know, if they've been in that same context and that same setting, they'll know what I'm talking about. And so like, yeah, I came into this work from my own running away from, you know, I said, I remember thinking the other day that my life was so dangerous. I was in such a dangerous relationship and the drug game didn't even seem dangerous, that my boyfriend was so dangerous that the drug dealers wasn't even scary. I didn't even have sense enough to be scared of the drug dealers because my boyfriend was so crazy that the drug dealer didn't scare me. They didn't wasn't even threatening. They were calm compared to who I had at home waiting, right? And that the jail was the safest place in the hood because what I had going on at home was much more dangerous than what I had happening downtown at the jail. And so and my boyfriend was so dangerous that the jail and the shelter and the conditions sometimes in the jails and the shelter oftentimes were so bad though that sometimes people would rather be dead as well, right? And so it's like this conundrum that people who have dealt with incarceration are constantly in. It's like you are just in this whirlwind all the time. So I got into this work because I felt like we were always in this space of, I don't know how to describe it sometimes. Like it's almost like I guess what enslaved people must have felt like, right? Like Harriet Tubman, like she ran away because she wanted to be free, but that pull of going back to get her people, like it's the most detestable thing in the world. You don't want to ever deal with it again, but my people are there, so I have to go back and deal with it. That's why I do policy work. It's the most detestable thing to me in the world. I have to. When I had to work on the shackling bill as a pregnant person, a formerly incarcerated pregnant person who was shackled, it was the most horrid thing to have to recall what it was like to be shackled while pregnant, but it was also the most necessary thing to do. That's why I do it, right? And so, yeah, I think of it, and when people ask me why I do it, it's a way to turn pain into and passion into policy and power. But I do have to acknowledge that it's bittersweet. I guess it's bittersweet. I guess today I'm not particularly happy about it. I mean, some days I smile about it. Today just happens to be a day I'm not particularly happy about it.
Yeah, that is just an extraordinary story, and I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that, you know, how, that striking dichotomy of finding your community of care inside the carceral system, inside prison, and whatever happened to people taking care of one another when it counts, right? When you're in your neighborhoods, in your schools, in your homes, that we should be doing that to divert people in the first place. And it's really frightening to think about what our society has turned into, right? We just sort of look the other way and we don't pay attention to these things. And that's part of the awareness here of Justice Radio is a wake-up call, right, for our citizens about what's really happening and to take a look around you in your own neighborhood, in your own schools, and see what you can do to reach out to folks who you may or may not know. I wonder if you might expand for just a minute on. Our listeners might not actually understand what the criminalization of survivorship means. So what does that actually look like for a woman?
Yeah, so it can look different in various ways, but for me specifically, and I can tell you a story of some folks, stories of folks that I know, but for me, it looked like when my boyfriend, who was very abusive, would engage in physical abuse, I or my neighbors would call the police, and the police would come, and they may or may not arrest him, and on multiple occasions. And so this one particular occasion, the police came and they said to me, "Listen, we come out here all the time and we're sick of coming out here. If we come again, we're going to arrest you the next time." And they did. The next time they came, I was battered and abused, but they arrested me because they were tired of coming. And they felt like if they arrested me, that might, I don't know, disrupt this cycle that we were in, maybe. I'm sure that's what they thought, but it didn't. Of course, it didn't do anything, but arrest me. So that was the first time I had ever been arrested, was for my own battery. I was, if you look at my mugshot, I was battered and abused. And that only thing that did was taught me a lesson, which was don't call the police. I have a friend who was shot in 2021 by her child's father with an AR-15 in the leg, and nothing happened. Nothing happened to him. And of course, she did what most victims. She didn't cooperate because he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again. I don't, you know, I know, as my boyfriend did too. I'll never do it again. I love you. I'll never do it again." So you don't cooperate and you say, "Okay, I'll drop the charges. I won't cooperate with the DA." And so they got into another argument in like 22. He was looking for the gun. She finds the gun and runs and hides. And, as he's looking for it, she runs and hides and gets it, hides it. And then he's looking for it. He's looking for it. She gets it, shoots him, kills him before he can shoot her. They charge her with murder and give her 25 years. Now he shoots her, nothing happens. She kills him in self-defense and gets 25 years. That is what the criminalization of survivorship looks like. Is she supposed to wait for him to shoot her again, this time fatally? Like, she's already been shot by a person. If someone shoots you, I'm not waiting for them to shoot me again. You know what I mean? That's just crazy. I'm not going to be the victim the second time. And so, women, the prisons are full of women who are there simply because they are there because of something that their boyfriend either did or did to them. And they responded to what happened. And so, the women don't get to defend themselves. They are either supposed to just absorb what happens to them and not respond. Or if you don't respond, oftentimes what happens then, they say, "Well, you are not able to maintain your safety." And so then the Department of Social Services comes and takes your children because you are a victim of abuse. So it's also the criminalization, because it removes the children, or you are then charged with abuse or neglect because you're not able to maintain your children's safety. So it can happen in so many different ways when your children are taken from you, or you are either your children are removed or you are removed from the home, is the criminalization of your victimhood.
You are listening to Creating Windows, Not Bars, Justice Radio with your hosts Linda Small and Mackenzie Kelly. Today we are talking to Christy Puckett about the injustice of females and racial injustice in the carceral state. I know before that you were speaking about SUD and lifting people up and all those sorts of things, because I think that's very important, especially being a woman with SUD myself. How many women do you feel like are actually affected by substance use disorder when in the carceral state? And what does that actually look like from where you stand?
I think of all the women who we know are involved in the carceral state, about probably 90%, only because, I mean, even if they're not using, right, then they are dealing in some way, right? Their children are using, so they're impacted by whether they themselves have a substance disorder, their loved ones are, right? Someone has died for it. So we are all like impacted by substance use disorder in some way, if even if we're not diagnosed with it. And even if it's not the substances, I think we spend a lot of time talking about substances, but it's really the addictive processes that are gambling, love, internet, all of the processes that don't get a lot of attention. If you're not careful, food, shopping, all of those things in our society are prevalent because people are not dealing with the underlying emotions. So even if we see people in recovery, like myself, if I'm not careful from the substances, like I can not be using substances, but I'm out at the store every day or I'm gambling. And so it's really about emotions. And a lot of the times we're not dealing with the emotions, and especially people coming home, we're not dealing with our underlying emotions, and we get into these relationships, relationship after relationship after relationship. So it's like a addictive process where we are stuck in these processes of not dealing with our emotions. And I think there are a lot of people, and especially women, who are dealing with folks, and we don't get to talk about our emotions in ways that are healthy, and in spaces that are healthy. We get seen as women, especially, are seen as hysterical and histrionic in a lot of spaces. It's just a lot of gender and binary kind of like stereotypes that are in the world. And I that's why the trans movement and like the LGBTQIA movement to me is amazing and wonderful, because it is just like breaking all of that up. Like, people are just free. Bodily autonomy is amazing. Like, people are just free to be. Right, you can't use clothing and facial hair and hairstyles to decide what someone's gender is or what pronouns to call them. You can't do that anymore. That was wrong in the first place, right? And you should have never been doing that. And skin color should have never been how you valued someone. Clothing should never been how, or hair color, hairstyle, none of those things should have been how you valued someone. And that's definitely how we have been placing value on people all of this time. Substance use disorder, status or criminal history, like all of these things should never be things of how we value people, but they definitely are. So I'm really glad that we are at a place where, especially the younger generation, is like questioning all of these things, like all of these identities, I guess, are being questioned. They are important. What I've been trying to say to folks is like all of these identities, substance use disorder, all of these things are important to note. But the most important identity that we have is humanity. So if we hold on to the most important identity, which is our common identity, which is our humanity, then we are doing something. Like, I don't want to deny any of your humanity, any of your identities. It is important for me to know like all of your identities because it is relevant. Like, I need to know your culture. I want to know how you identify, because those things help me understand you. But there's a basic understanding that we're gonna have, which is your humanity, and we're never gonna go beneath that basic, right? And we're never gonna go beneath that. And all the other things you want me to know about you, that's beautiful and wonderful. That's icing, you know, that's the cherry on top, right? And I think that's what we got to get to as people. As a people. When I say a people, I mean all the people, whoever you voting for, you know, whoever you voting for, right? It's a basic. We done got away from the basics, you know, because people done got real crazy and thinking they can talk to you and say anything to you based on who they voted. And then we just can't do that. There's just a certain baseline we got to get back to with our common fellow people, regardless of who they voting for.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful synopsis of sort of where we've gone awry, and it sounds like you're digging into the root causes of what's happening, right? To how we treat one another as human beings, or don't treat one another as human beings. And then once we veer off that, then there's a whole host of issues that crop up from that. And that is also the root causes of, incarceration and substance use disorder, and why we even have the word survivorship or victimhood, right? It's all of those things are networked together right down at the very basic of how we see and treat one another, either as human beings or some subform, right, of being human. And that's really the root of what I hear you saying. So I'm wondering if you might have some advice from the folks listening about, you know, what is the next step for them? What can they possibly do to help break down those either racial, economic, social barriers, class barriers, political barriers, on a day-to-day basis? What would you suggest that, you know, a person do? Because I think we each individually have a responsibility and need to take ownership for how we treat one another.
Yeah, well, I think that the things that people can do is they have to, number one, educate themselves, right? Education, I think, is so important. Most people are not just even aware of what's happening in their own local community. Local politics is super duper important. Most people are more concerned about the federal elections, but local politics is super important. Super, 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 super important. Yeah, local politics, I would say. So when I say local, I mean your city and county and in your state. What's happening at your state level is going to be very, very important. And knowing what's happening in your community with your neighbors and your neighbors, making sure that the least of your neighbors are taken care of, right? Because if the people that have the least are being cared for, then literally every other person in your community is going to be cared for. And if you are a person who is of means, then that means that you need to divest and, you know, of some of from some of those means and be willing to give up some of those means to the people who don't have, literally. I mean, it literally means giving up some of that privilege. That looks different for different people. I mean, I can't really write out a prescription. And I guess, you know, Bryan Stevenson gives folks, I guess, a really good way to do it. He says that folks should, you know, get proximate to the problem. It's impossible to change the world when you're working at a distance. So you got to find ways to get closer to people who are poor, who are neglected, to who are abused, who are marginalized. You have to work on changing the narrative. You have to be uncomfortable, and then you have to remain hopeful. And so, like, I think that's sound advice, to be quite honest. I mean, he's worked with people who are on death row and have gotten them off. I've worked in a state legislature in a supermajority and have the other side, conservative side, have told me there's not a snowball chance in hell that you're going to get this prison reform bill passed. And we've gotten it passed. And that person had to vote to get it passed. Hell, you know, was one of the people who voted. We got it all support, full support, unanimous vote, right? So remaining hopeful and, you know, is important, and staying the course is important, and being uncomfortable, having strange bedfellows, and staying authentic, I think, is also super important. But that narrative, I think, probably is the most important thing that a person can do, especially if you've been directly impacted by the harms of this system. I think shifting narrative is how we shift the norms of society. History is told by the victors often. And so what gets lost is those in power get to tell their narrative, oftentimes is the dominant narrative. And so how do we, that's why this Justice Radio is so important, because the narrative of the wardens and the narrative of the police and the court reporters, all of those transcripts and all of that stuff that they said has been the dominant narrative. But here we are, folks who have been accused, convicted. We have an opportunity now through podcasts and radios and all of this to have our own narrative. And this is an opportunity to tell our own stories. And so I think that at any chance that we have to reframe the narrative about who we are and what we experienced inside of those cages, that's what we can do. And so people who have not had these experiences that hear these type of stories or that run across a Justice Radio or a podcast to share, to listen, to amplify, to send money, that is what they should be doing. Linda has a house. Reentry Sisters has a website, I'm sure. Donate. Listeners need to support the work that you're doing here in New England. That's what needs to happen, because how can work happen without money? When you see good work happening, support it. There's an initiation that happened to get into this club, unfortunately, that a lot of people did not have to experience. And because we were hazed in a specific way, there's a scarring that we all carry. And those that were fortunate enough to not have that specific scarring, they should pay reparations to those of us that did. And so if you're listening to this episode, I want you to get your phone out right now and go to the Reentry Sisters website and click the donate button and get these people some money. Because hell, they sacrificed many years, a lot of time and energy, so you could sit here and listen to us talk about, and so you could learn and be educated on some subjects that you might not know nothing about. And so that is what you can do, is give your money because you already given your time and you've already given the most precious thing that you can't get back, which is listening to this episode. So what's $10? You feel me? What is 10 more dollars, baby? Just give it on up. And that's my little plug for the day, Linda. Did I do good, Linda? No, but seriously, changing the narrative and giving a few dollars, that's always going to be appreciated, because this work is it's difficult, man. Having to relive some of the worst days of your life in order to so that you didn't live those days in vain. See, it wasn't for naught. Those days were not just for. I didn't live those days just to be living them. That's why I'm out here every day, because it wasn't just because if I don't do this work, then I was just living those days for nothing. Then they was just for nothing. And so those days just can't be for nothing. They have to mean something. They have to mean something. And so every day that I'm out here working on a policy, those days mean something. And so, Linda, you didn't spend all those days. Mackenzie, you didn't spend all those days for nothing. We spent those days for something. And every day that we do this work, those days mean something. So I appreciate everything y'all are doing. And I'm so grateful for y'all allowing me to be on here with y'all today. I really appreciate it.
And we're grateful for you being here. You know,
Anytime.
I think it's amazing that you're giving back with Forward Justice and everything that you do. And it's great because really we are giving back to the community, you know, because we all have a past, right? We might as well use it for something. It wasn't for nothing. And I fully agree with that. So,
Absolutely.
thank you, Christy Puckett, for sharing the incredible work that you do at Forward Justice and how our listeners can become involved in social justice movements that they care about. In coming shows, we will explore public safety, the unique stigma justice-impacted women face, and the experiences and struggles of returning citizens to create meaningful and productive lives.
Visit the Justice Radio show page on WMPG.org. For archived episodes aired on WMPG, WERU, and WMHB. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in Justice Radio.